Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Sue Monk Kidd, author of The Secret Life of Bees, When the Heart Waits, and The Dance of the Dissident Daughter. She'll talk about her latest book, The Invention of Wings, an extraordinary and moving story of slavery and the uneasy friendship between abolitionist Sarah Grimke and Hetty, her unwanted, quote, present. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday evening, May 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Cindy Kugler, former director of the Center for Faith Studies.
Perhaps many of you were here in 2005 when the Center for Faith Studies was host to noted author Sue Monk Kidd upon the release of her book, The Mermaid Chair. Happily then, in September of 2010, we again welcomed Sue and her daughter, author Anne Kidd Taylor, for traveling with pomegranates. I think we have a 5-year pattern firmly in place now as we gather tonight to welcome Sue yet again to lift up and celebrate her most recent book, The Invention of Wings. Many thanks to Viking and Penguin Books for the strong relationship we have enjoyed with them for the past 10 years, and especially thanks to Rebecca Lang, senior publicist, who's traveling on tour with Sue and joins us also this evening. The Invention of Wings, Sue Monk Kidd's third novel, was published January 7, 2014 by Viking to wide critical acclaim. It debuted on the New York Times bestseller list at number 1 and remained on the hardcover fiction list for over 6 months. It has been translated into 20 languages thus far. Plans are underway to turn the book into a film. From Sue's website, I quote, "This exquisitely written novel is a triumph of storytelling that looks with unswerving eyes at one of the most devastating wounds in American history. This is a story told in voices of women whose struggles for liberation, empowerment, and expression will leave no reader unmoved." From the celebrated author of The Secret Life of Bees, "This is a masterpiece of hope, daring, the quest for freedom, and the desire to have a voice in the world." Please help me welcome Sue Monk Kidd.
Thank you. I am very happy to be back in Omaha. And I want to know if you're looking for the dark-haired lady. I felt a need to explain that because I just hate it when the author shows up and she doesn't match her picture on the book jacket. But the dark-haired lady disappeared recently, and she went with the natural color, so I wanted to assure you that I am Sue Monk Kidd. I passed by some people who I don't think had a clue that this was the author. I am really happy to be back in Omaha, and I mean that sincerely. It's an honor to be part of this faith studies series that you have here and to be at Countryside Community Church. I loved coming here in 2005. I like coming every 5 years. So we have a date 5 years from now, maybe I'll come back. I was here with my daughter last, and we were reminiscing on the telephone today about our time here about 5 or so years ago. I'm particularly pleased to come back with The Invention of Wings. And I want to quote the first 4 paragraphs to you from the novel. It begins like this. "There was a time in Africa the people could fly. My mama told me this when I was 10 years old. She said, handful, your granny mama saw it for herself. She say they flew over trees and clouds. She say they flew like blackbirds. When we came here, we left that magic behind." My mama was shrewd. She didn't get any reading and writing like me. Everything she knew came from living on the scarce side of mercy. She looked at my face, how it flowed with sorrow and doubt, and she said, "You don't believe me? Where you think these shoulder blades of yours come from, girl?" Those skinny bones stuck out from my back like nubs. She patted them and said, "This all what left of your wings. They just these flat bones now. But one day, you're going to get them back." I was shrewd like Mama. Even at 10, I knew this story about people flying was pure malarkey. We weren't some magic people. We were slave people, and we weren't going anywhere. It was later I saw what she meant. We could fly all right, but there wasn't any magic to it. I wanted to recite these opening paragraphs to you because, in a way, I feel like they contain the distilled essence of the whole book. When I wrote them, I thought to myself, okay, if I can just now extrapolate on those paragraphs, I can write this entire story, because I think they contain that innate, universal thing in human beings, which is the truth-telling I think you're talking about, which is this struggle and quest and yearning for freedom to transcend our limitations. And the book is about two women who are attempting to do that, to invent their wings, so to speak. In 2007, I went to the Brooklyn Museum in New York to see the Judy Chicago Dinner Party exhibit. It had just opened, and I wasn't really looking for a novel idea. I was busy working on Traveling with Pomegranates, and I was reading the names on the heritage panels that are right outside the exhibit of 999 names of women who've made significant contributions to Western history. And to my husband's dismay, I was reading all 999 of these names. And I came upon the names of two sisters, Sarah and Angelina Grimke, and I stopped dead in my tracks because they were from Charleston, South Carolina, where we were living at the time. And I'd never heard of these women. And this was baffling to me. I felt that it was a failure on my part that I didn't know about them. I thought I'd read a lot of women's history. But I also think it has something to do with Chicago's premise, which is that sometimes women's contributions to history can fall by the wayside. And I discovered that, indeed, Sarah and Angelina had fallen in a crack in history somewhere, and that outside of some academic circles, they really weren't very well known. In Charleston, they weren't mentioned very much. They had a reputation as being the black sheep of Charleston. These things die hard in Charleston. And only last week, I'm very thrilled to tell you, Charleston threw open its arms in this very public and official way to the Grimke sisters and unveiled a historical marker at their childhood home. The mayor and I got to pull the veil off of this marker, and it was a really exciting moment for me to see them embrace these women and their contribution. I felt like it was a reconciliation, and I talked about it that way as a homecoming for them. So I think that is an incredible moment for the city of Charleston and for these women's homeland there. As it turned out, I had been driving by their house for 10 years and didn't have a clue they lived there. They were the first female abolition agents in America and among our earliest and most vocal pioneers for women's rights in this country. I became completely captivated by them. I came home, I read everything I could find about them. There's not voluminous amounts, but there is some biographies and other compilations of essays that they have and so forth. So I read everything I could find. And I fell under the spell of these sisters, and I knew almost immediately I wanted to write a novel in the voice of one of them, and I chose Sarah. I think what really compelled me about them was, how could this happen? I'm always interested in the internal process that goes on inside of us. that has to do with our transformations. I think this is the most interesting thing to me in my work, is trying to understand that in people. So how did Sarah and Angelina Grimke, who were from this wealthy, aristocratic, slaveholding family in the heart of the South at the turn of the century, in the early 19th century, end up becoming some of our earliest feminist thinkers in America, and not only abolitionists, but they were way ahead of the abolitionists. Actually, they were not only for emancipation of slavery, but they were for equal parity among the races. They believed in equality, and that was something that not all abolitionists did believe in, actually. So I was very taken with this process, and I wanted to understand it, and I think that was what was driving me to write this book, is how this could happen. They were moving in the most elite circles of society in Charleston, and yet they ended up exiles and pariahs. There are few women that have ever misbehaved so thoroughly as those two. This is why I fell in love with them. They were real dissident daughters. You know that saying, well-behaved women seldom make history? Well, I would argue that in the 1830s, Sarah and Angelina were maybe the most radical women to come out of the antebellum South. But they had to undergo this really long, painful metamorphosis. They had to break with their family, most all of their family, their homeland, their traditions, their culture, their church, which supported slavery. In fact, in America, one of the pillars that supported slavery, beside education and the government, was religion, which is very hard to hear. So from the moment that I decided I would write this novel in the voice of Sarah Grimke, I also knew that I would want to write the story of an enslaved woman and entwine this story with Sarah's. And I felt so strongly about this that I told myself if I couldn't do that, I wouldn't write the novel. And this was incredibly daunting to me, actually. I knew this was going to take me way out on the literary limb. Then I discovered a notation in Sarah's journal in which she talks about being given what is euphemistically called a waiting maid. This is sort of code for enslaved girl, which was a custom. She was around maybe 11 or 12 years old. She was given a slave named Hetty, who was about her same age, perhaps even younger. And what Sarah said about her is that she taught her to read. They were caught and punished for this because it was against the law to teach an enslaved person to read in South Carolina at the time. So we don't know anything else about Hetty except that she died very young, probably not long after Sarah acquired her, and that Sarah was kind of heartbroken about all of this. And when I read that, I thought, oh, here's my other character. This is the other voice in the novel, and this is the character I want to bring to life. And imagine what might have been if she had lived. And I just wanted to somehow be a witness to a life that never really happened. What kind of relationship would they have across this huge divide? How would they affect each other's destinies? How can they relate? Can love be involved in something like that? Is it possible? Where's the redemption in all of this? Well, I want to introduce you to Hetty Handful and Sarah tonight. And I want to read a passage first from Handful, who in this passage is just becoming part of her ordinary world. That this is where I like to start my novels, actually, in what Joseph Campbell called the ordinary world. So I open the stories where we can see them right before this call to adventure comes and begins their narrative journey. In this particular passage, Handful is 10 years old. The place is Charleston, South Carolina, and it's 1803. Already that morning, Mrs. had taken her cane stick to me once across my backside for falling asleep during her devotions. Every day, all us slaves, everyone but Rosetta, who was old and demented, jammed in the dining room before breakfast to fight off sleep, while Mrs. taught us short Bible verses like Jesus wept and prayed out loud about God's favorite subject, obedience. If you nodded off, you got whacked right in the middle of God said this and God said that. I was full of sass to Aunt Sister about the whole miserable business. I'd say, let this cup pass from me, spouting one of Mrs. verses. I'd say, Jesus wept because he's trapped in there with Mrs. like us. Aunt Sister was the cook. She'd been with Mrs. since Mrs. was a girl, and next to Tomfrey the butler, she ran the whole show. She was the only one who could tell Mrs. what to do without getting whacked by the cane. Mama said, watch your tongue, but I never did. Aunt Sister popped me backward 3 times a day. I was a handful. That's not how I got my name, though. Handful was my basket name. The master and missus, they did all the proper naming, but a mama would look on her baby laid in its basket, and a name would come to her. Something about what her baby looked like, what day of the week it was, what the weather was doing, or just how the world seemed on that day. My mama's basket name was Summer, but her proper name was Charlotte. She had a brother whose basket name was Hard Time. People think I make that up, but it's true as can be. If you got a basket name, you at least had something from your mama. Master Grimke named me Hetty, but mama looked on me the day I came into the world, how I was born too soon, and she called me Handful. I think when someone says slavery, and today what we might picture is plantation slavery. We might picture cotton fields and slave cabins. But this novel is attempting to look at something else. It was really common in American life at the time, and that's urban slavery. So these were mostly house slaves in these great palatial mansions in Charleston. Charleston was about the 4th largest city in America at 1803. It had a larger black population than a white population, more slaves and free blacks. And yet the city was controlled through a system of urban slavery that was controlled through surveillance, city guards, badges, passes, all kinds of ordinances to keep this system in place. It was, I think, a brutal system. It was every bit as brutal as the plantation system. And there was something I uncovered in my research, I think, that was probably the most disturbing thing that I uncovered. And there were days, actually, when I was doing research and reading particularly 19th century slave narratives, that I'd have to get up and leave my desk and go take a walk in order to just take in the vast amount of human cruelty, of casual cruelty, just banal cruelty that I was reading about. One of these was something called the workhouse, which existed in a lot of cities of any size. In Charleston, it was called the Sugar House, which is indeed interesting because it was a place you could send slaves to be punished for a fee. In Charleston, you could buy 20 lashes for a half dollar. So it was in this environment in Charleston that this story unfolds. And I thought, it was critically important to look at that very clearly and to try to tell the truth about it. One of the largest slave plots in American history was hatched in Charleston at the same time. And this was the Denmark Vesey insurrection. That never really happened. It was a thwarted plot. But if it had happened, it would have been, we would all have remembered it, believe me. And I wanted to intersect Vesey's life with those of my characters, Handful and her mother, Charlotte, not only because this was a way to insert a lot of excellent drama into the story, but because it gave me a way to acknowledge the way that enslaved people and free blacks struggled and died and rebelled and subverted this system. I really don't think that they have gotten the credit that they really deserve in history for the way they fought against slavery and really had a hand in freeing themselves. I think the abolitionists have the lion's share of the credit. This idea that slaves were happy members of the family is a travesty, and it is something that has persisted in the public imagination, particularly in the South. I guess there's a mystery involved in why a novelist will return to a certain motif over and over again. I've written a lot about race and race relations. In The Secret Life of Bees, I visited that time as in civil rights. But this time, I wanted to go back to ground zero, so to speak, to slavery, because this is the legacy that has left us with racism. And I wanted to look at that legacy and how it started to see if we could understand it. I think it was Kierkegaard who said, we have to live forward, but we can only understand life backward. And I think we have to go back to these critical places and really look at them to understand where we are and where we're going. This is a very personal subject for me. I grew up in pre-civil rights South. I remember witnessing terrible racial cruelties and divides. This was the backdrop of separate water fountains, Rosa Parks, civil rights marches. I was 13 when Martin Luther King Jr. marched near my hometown in Georgia and was jailed and arrested in the city where I was born, Albany, Georgia. I graduated from the first integrated high school in my little town in Georgia, and I vividly remember the balled-up newspaper that would be thrown at these three students as they walked the halls that year. This made a deep impression on me. That scene actually ended up in The Secret Life of Bees. But this is the stuff of my childhood. It's the stuff of my history. And I guess I felt some kind of personal responsibility to be a witness to some of that. Social justice is at the very core of who I am. And so I suppose that's why I always seem to circle back to this topic. Well, I want to also introduce you to Sarah Grimke and give you a glimpse of her ordinary world in the opening pages of the novel. And this particular passage I want to read in her voice comes the night that she was given a birthday present. She's 11 years old, and her present is a human being, which was actually a practice that happened, giving enslaved people as birthday presents or anniversary presents or wedding gifts. So she's been given Hetty Handful, and she is grappling with that the night after. I think even at 10 or 11 or 12 years old, the historical Sarah was really struggling and forming her own moral compass. I picked my way along the Persian rug that ran the near length of the main passage, turned the knob to Father's library, and stepped inside. An ornately framed portrait of George Washington was lit with a scrim of moonlight coming through the front window. For almost a year, Father had looked the other way as I'd slipped beneath Mr. Washington's nose to plunder the library. John, Thomas, and Frederick had total reign over his vast trove, books of law, geography, philosophy, theology, history, botany, poetry, and the Greek humanities, while Mary and I were officially forbidden to read a word of it. Mary didn't seem to care for books, but I dreamed of them in my sleep. I loved them in a way I couldn't express even to Thomas. He was the only one who knew my desperation to acquire a true education beyond the one I received at the hands of Madame Ruffin, my tutor and French nemesis. She was a small, hot-tempered woman who wore a widow's cap with strings floating at her cheeks, and when it was cold, a squirrely fur cloak and tiny fur-lined shoes. She was known to line girls up on the idle bench for the smallest infraction and scream at them until they fainted. I despised her and her polite education for the female mind. It was composed of needlework, manners, drawing, basic reading, penmanship, piano, Bible, French, and enough arithmetic to add two and two. I thought it possible I might die from tracing teensy flowers on the pages of my art tablet. Once I wrote in the margin, "If I should die of this horrid exercise, I wish these flowers to adorn my coffin." Madame Ruffin was not amused. I was made to stand on the idle bench where she ranted at my insolence and where I forced myself not to faint. Increasingly, during those classes, longings had seized me, foreign, torrential aches that overran my heart. I wanted to know things, to become someone. Oh, to be a son. I adored Father because he treated me almost as if I were a son, allowing me to slip in and out of his library. On that night, the coals in the fireplace lay cold, and the smell of cigar smoke still pooled in the air. Without effort, I located Father's South Carolina Justice of the Peace and Public Laws, which he himself had authored. I'd thumbed through it enough to know somewhere in the pages was a copy of a legal manumission document. Upon finding it, I took paper and quill from Father's desk and copied it. I hereby certify that on this day, 26 November 1803, in the city of Charleston in the state of South Carolina, I set free from slavery Hetty Grimke and bestow this certificate of manumission upon her, Sarah Moore Grimke. What could Father do but make Hetty's freedom as legal and binding as her ownership? I was following a code of law he'd fashioned himself. I left my handiwork atop the backgammon box on his desk. Well, as you can imagine, that will not work at all. This scene hints at the other major motif in the novel, which is gender. A white woman in South Carolina in the early 19th century had shockingly few rights. Doing my research, it was really unbelievable, astonishing to me how limited women really were. And I thought, wow, how soon we forget, you know. Women, not only could they not vote, they had no right to property in South Carolina. They couldn't write a will. They couldn't testify in court. Essentially, they were the property of their husbands, and they had no right even to their own children. And this was fairly pervasive in America at the time. Their purpose in life, and this was deep in the culture, was to marry, have children, and live their lives within the domestic sphere where they were welcome to rule, but not outside of it. There was no voice whatsoever. So just as I came of age in pre-Civil Rights South, I also came of age in pre-feminist America. In 1963, when Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique, I was sitting in my freshman high school home economics class in my little town of 3,500 in Georgia, literally learning how to make a man's home into a castle. That was really some textbook. I wish I had a copy of it still. I remember the day that the teacher wrote the list of vocations for women on the blackboard. There weren't very many. And I see some of you who have the same natural hair color I have, who might also remember this. I bet you could name the vocations for women at the time in 1963 in a little town in the South. Teacher, nurse, librarian, right? We could go on down the line. Now, the reason this day is in my mind so vividly, in my memory still, is because I had this deep and formidable desire to be a writer, and it was not on the board. And I remember sitting there waiting expectantly for her to write writer, but it wasn't there. And this actually closed something up inside of me that day. I remember it very vividly. It felt like a loss to me at the time. So when I went to college, I studied nursing. Now, I believe nursing is an incredibly noble profession, and that was why I chose it. I couldn't think of anything better to do than be a nurse that was on the board. But it wasn't my place of belonging, and I think we're all searching for our place of belonging in the world, which is another theme I have. I mean, that was the major theme for me in The Secret Life of Bees, is finding our place of belonging. Coming home in the most metaphoric and soulful kind of way I'm talking about. And I think that's what I began to do in my late 20s, was to feel the restlessness of wanting to find my place of belonging. But at 18, I had not yet figured out how to think and act outside of the confines of the world that shaped me. And that world really does shape you in the South, trust me. So I had to have 8 years after college before I could break out, find my own voice, or begin to find my own voice, and begin to write. That reminds me, actually, a little bit of Sarah Grimke. I mean, she also struggled deeply to find her place of belonging, to find her voice, her own consciousness in the world. And she had failures of courage like I did. And like me, she was a little slow to take her leap at times. She was a lot slower than a novelist wants, believe me. There's a moment in this novel where Handful looks at Sarah and says, "My body might be a slave, but not my mind. For you, it's the other way around." Sarah's quest was for a different kind of freedom. Of course, Handful was looking to freedom from slavery. Sarah had to free her mind and her spirit. It was an internal kind of liberation that she needed. She had to discover a sense of herself in a time when it was infinitely harder than in 1963, 64, 65. In fact, it's not only discovering one's sense of self, it's finding the boldness to actually declare that self. And I would argue that this is a very classic feminine journey for women, even today. Both Sarah and Handful had to undergo that very classic feminine journey. I wrote a scene in the novel when Handful was in the copper bathtub. Someone pointed out to me not long ago that there's a baptism in every novel I've written. And it's true. There really is. I don't consciously do it. It just turns up, and then I look at it and go, oh, there it is again. Sarah, in this novel, The Invention of Wings, Sarah has her baptism moment. And Handful has hers, and it's in a copper tub. And it's the moment where she begins to come to her sense of her own self, the value of her own life, to hear her own voice speaking inside of her, and find the first intimations of audacity to declare it. As Handful's mother said to her one time, you got to figure out which end of the needle you gonna be, the one fastened to the thread or the one that pierces the cloth. And that is, I think, a moment in most women's lives where they have to begin to figure that out. This paragraph, I want to read one more paragraph from Sarah, comes on the cusp of her public crusade for abolition. And she was very daunted by this whole process because she had not a full-blown speech impediment, but she had difficulty speaking. She was not a great public speaker. Now, her sister Angelina was a great orator. Sarah was the thinker. And she had a great shyness about speaking in public and was often a mumbler. And it sort of dogged her whole life. And she's very worried about going out there on this public campaign for abolition. So this is the night before, as she's struggling with whether to accept this invitation, which is going to take her out on this public stage and really change American history in a way. I stared at the blank plank of rafter over my head, and it came to me that what I feared was not speaking. That fear was old and tired. What I feared was the immensity of it all. A female abolition agent traveling the country with a national mandate. I wanted to say, who am I to do this, a woman? But that voice was not mine. It was Father's voice. It was Thomas's. It belonged to Israel, to Catherine, and to Mother. It belonged to the church in Charleston and the Quakers in Philadelphia. It would not, if I could help it, belong to me. Sarah and Angelina go out on this crusade, and they face enormous backlash. One of the things that I really wanted to get across in this novel is that it was in fighting for the rights of others that historically women in this country have discovered the oppression of their own injustice. This was repeated in the 60s during the Vietnam War as women marched for peace and found that they had no voice in that campaign. It was true in the 19th century as well. The Grimke sisters are the ones who linked abolition and women's rights. 10 years before the Seneca Falls first women's rights convention in America, Sarah and Angelina were out there taking the first blows of backlash. What they were fighting for was a woman's right to speak in the public sphere, to come out of the parlor, out of domesticity, and to have a voice. And the right not only to do that, but to speak to mixed audiences. And I'm not talking about race, I'm talking about gender. It was unheard of for women to speak publicly to men. There's a line in the novel that I really loved writing. I'm going to claim it as my favorite line in the novel. It's only 4 words. And I put these words in the mouth of Lucretia Mott, who's also a women's rights pioneer and abolitionist, a great American, who is a minor character in the novel. She sends this message to Sarah and Angelina at some of the most violent and stunning backlash against them as they campaigned in the North. The words are, "Press on, my sisters." And when I wrote those words, I realized it was really I who wanted to say those words to Sarah and Angelina so badly. I've been asked, what do you want readers to take away from the invention of wings? I've been asked this numerous times. And I've thought about this. And I think you want, of course, as a novelist, for readers to learn something. You know, you want to enlighten the mind and have your novel be a carrier of ideas. So maybe the reader might learn something about American slavery or urban slavery that they didn't know before, or discover the Grimke sisters or rediscover them, or learn something about 19th century history. But my biggest hope really is that readers will have a felt experience of the book. In other words, feel what it's like to be an enslaved person, or feel what it's like to be a white woman without any rights. I guess what I'm talking about is empathy. And I think that is one of the most mysterious transactions in human experience. This ability we have to take another's experience and make it our own and feel it and have an emotional reaction to it. It's when you bring the mind down into the heart that this can happen. And I think this is the real power of literature. I think it's the real power of narrative and of story, that it holds that power. When I was in college, I was very big on Ralph Waldo Emerson, still am actually. And I remember reading his concept of the common heart. And he said that the common heart is a place inside every human being where we share an intrinsic unity with every other human being. I thought that was both brilliant and beautiful, and I never forgot it. As a novelist, as a writer, as a person, I believe in that place. And I can't think of anything that I would hope more for my work than it would be a portal, even a tiny portal, into the common heart. I think this is the saving place. In the author's note at the end of the novel, I quote some words by Professor Julius Lester. And I wrote them on a 3x5 card the day I started the novel. And I put them up in front of my computer monitor. And I essentially read them every single day for 4 years while I worked on this book. And I want to leave them with you. History is not just facts and events. History is a pain in the heart, and we will repeat history until we make another's pain in the heart our own. Thank you. We're going to have some questions.
Please raise your hand if you have questions, and we'll come to you with a microphone.
Did you write in chronological order, or did you work on just what scene you liked, or from an outline, or by the seat of your pants? Or
all of the above, no. I worked chronologically writing. I did a loose outline of the book. I mean, I had a historical script there, and I had to play by it. And that was one of the reasons that Sarah, her voice was a little harder for me to capture I had to struggle to get her voice. It took me several months to feel like I had gotten it, because she came with a very big historical script, and I revered that script, and I didn't want to veer off of it. So I had to tell myself, you're not a historian, you're not a biographer, you're a novelist, so you need to invent, so you have to let her veer off script a little bit. And it was when I began to blend imagination and history that I think her voice came alive for me. But because of that script, you know, I knew what was going to happen. And I feel like if you read the book, you will come away knowing Sarah Grimke's life and history, her turning points, who she was. I mean, there's a lot of factual detail in there about her. But Handful, I could just let her go. You know, she had free rein of my imagination, and because of that, she just was very talkative. You know? And her voice came much easier to me. It was much more accessible to me than Sarah's, which was a surprise in a way. So what I did was begin at the beginning and just knew Sarah's chronology, and then tried to write a narrative for Handful that had the same kind of substance and weight that could go alongside of it and look at this world from two lenses. And so, yes, it was a lot by the seat of my pants, but I did have an outline to go by.
I was wondering, we had toured the Aiken Rhett House in Charleston and the backgrounds, and I was wondering if you use that as an inspiration in this book to describe the Grimke slave quarters.
You're very perceptive, yes. I did, exactly. It was the Aiken Rhett House. It's a beautiful example of, in fact, it's one of the only preserved historical work yards, they're called, in Charleston or anywhere. So if you go to Charleston, a city I love, and lived there for 13 years, you should go to this house. It's Aiken Rhett House, and you can see I used it as a model for the novel, for the work yard, where the slaves lived, the kitchen house, the carriage house, the laundry house. I mean, it's all there, and the slave quarters above the kitchen and the stables. It's really well preserved and beautiful. But there, if you do go to Charleston, they have Grimke's sister walking tours there now. So you can find out more about them.
I have a great appreciation for quilts, and I was fascinated in the book when you wrote about Handful's mother making her life quilt. I wonder if you did any research and reading on that. Were any ever found and preserved and shown? Do you know?
Yes. There are not many so-called slave quilts left, but the two that I do know of, they're archived, so they're not really on display now as far as I know. One is in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and one is in the Smithsonian, in the American History Museum. And they're by an enslaved woman named Harriet Powers. She was the inspiration for this quilt in The Invention of Wings. I wanted a way for Charlotte, my Handful's mother, to tell her story in a very tangible, concrete way. I mean, there was the oral tradition, and it was very viable and strong tradition. But how does a woman or anyone who's enslaved, who's forbidden to read and write, how do you preserve your traditions, your history, your personal history, your culture? How do you do that? And it occurred to me that you might stitch it. You might, beside an oral, I was looking for a visual way to do it. And so I wanted her to use her needle and thread, like paper and pencil, paper and pen, and create a visual memoir. And that's something that could be passed down like an oral tradition. So that was what I wanted. And then I discovered these amazing quilts by Harriet Powers, which are, they're really masterpieces. And they let me go back. If you make a request, tell them you're researching a novel. They'll take you right back in the archives. And pull out a drawer, and there's this incredible quilt, and each square tells a story. And the ones that Harriet Powers did are Bible quilts, and they tell Bible stories, or they tell local legends, but a lot of people feel there's a subtext in there of loss and pain and their lives. So they can be kind of a subversive act, actually.
I've spent a lot of time writing published nonfiction, and as someone who started their career writing nonfiction, do you have any advice for writers who are transitioning from nonfiction to writing fiction as I'm working on a novel?
Press on, my sister. No, I mean that, really. It's writing is all about courage, as most things are. It's about having the courage to write your truth in your authentic voice and believe in it and doubt it at the same time. And I say that because it works for me to both believe in what I'm doing utterly and then paradoxically to doubt it as I do, because that keeps me honest, and it keeps me working hard. It keeps me committed to it if I'm also doubting it at the same time. And it keeps me grounded. But if you go too far one way or the other, it's crippling. So I believe in the kind of balance of those two things. So I would throw that out. It's really about, I've said, I like to think of myself as a seasoned beginner. And I really mean that. When I started, every time I start a novel, it feels like I've never done it before. So don't be overwhelmed by that. I mean, no matter how many books one writes, one still feels like a beginner somewhere inside. And, you know, that's full of possibility. There's a Zen saying, in the expert's mind, there's no possibility, but in the beginner's mind, there's infinite possibility. You know? So beginning is a good thing. And so I would just say, press on.
Yeah. I just wondered if you would reflect on or weigh in on the fact that Angelina was given to Sarah to raise, and the power that that may have given Sarah to not be a single voice and to have a fellow person in her empowerment. And if Angelina had been given to Mary to raise, how it may have changed the course of history.
Good point. Well, Sarah was 13 years older than Angelina, and she became her godmother. She begged and begged to be the godmother of this baby, not knowing it would be a little girl. And it was an odd request, and her parents granted it reluctantly. And so because of this, she took this role on very seriously. And what she did was actually quite subversive. She taught Angelina everything she believed and knew about anti-slavery. She schooled her in her own ideas so that she would have an ally, I think. And the two of them together were a force. I mean, they were a force because, as I described it in the novel, Sarah says, I was one wing, Angelina was the other. These two lives were entwined, and it was really complex. You know, if they were to be on a psychiatrist's couch, I don't know what they would do with these two. Because Angelina called her older sister mother up until she was an adult almost. She was like a daughter to her. She was also a sister to her. when they would pull each other along, when one had a failure of courage, the other one would rise to the occasion and pull the other one up. So it was a complementary balancing act that they did. And, you know, I thought about this. I thought how we need community, how we need the other wing sometimes. And they did this for each other in a beautiful way. And if they hadn't had each other, I don't know that it would have turned out the same way historically, because they lit a fuse. They were, as I referred to them in the novel, they were female incendiaries. They were the ones who lit the fuse for women's rights. And they did it through this interesting synergy that they had.
Well, I too had the privilege of visiting Charleston last summer. And while we were there, we had gone basically to see the ships in the harbor. But while we were there, we went to a farm that had existed during slave days and after slave days. And I bought two small paperback books. One of them had to do with the Gullah, which you did mention in your book. And the other one was a series of stories of ex-slaves, the ones that had been freed, that was collected by the government, I think in the late 20s or the early 30s, and they're in the Library of Congress. I was wondering if you had access to any of those to kind of help with your background, because they were pretty, the ones that I read that were in this little pamphlet were very eye-opening, I guess. Mm-hmm. I would say.
I'll say, yes. Those narratives you're referring to were very helpful to me, actually. Those were created by the government. They sent out people to, they realized suddenly that the last living slaves were going to die, and that the stories would be lost. So people went around and collected their stories and wrote them down. There's a wealth of them. I mean, there's many, many stories that are out there that can be read. Those stories were in the 1930s, basically. And then the other set of narratives were from the 19th century, narratives like 12 Years a Slave. Or Harriet Jacobs was a narrative that I would, if you really want to read a dramatic story in the words of an enslaved person, read Harriet Jacobs. I thought it was far more harrowing even than 12 Years a Slave. But all of those were very, very helpful to me, yes.
Thank you, Sue Monk Kidd.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Sue Monk Kidd, author of The Secret Life of Bees, When the Heart Waits, and The Dance of the Dissident Daughter. Her topic this evening has been her latest book, The Invention of Wings. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday evening, May 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Kelly Keller, director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture program in the Center for Faith Studies series will be this coming Thursday evening, October 22nd. The guest speaker will be Thomas A. Barron, best-selling author of Lost Years of Merlin, Merlin's Dragon, and The Tree of Avalon, and winner of the Grumman Prize for Lifetime Contribution to Children and Young Adult Literature. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.